Hello, I'm Carla Chamberlain, Professor of Applied Linguistics and Communication Arts and Sciences at the Pennsylvania State University, Abington College, near Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'm joined by Matt Kahn, Director of the Center for International Understanding and Assistant Professor of ESL at the Community College of Philadelphia. And Matt and I are here today to talk to Ingrid Piller, Distinguished Professor of Applied Linguistics at Macquarie University in Sydney. Dr. Piller is author of the award-winning and best-selling books, Linguistic Diversity and Social Justice, and Intercultural Communication, A Critical Introduction. She is editor-in-chief of the international journal Multilingua, editor of the blog Language on the Move, and author of numerous publications about multilingualism and social justice. Mac and I each came to know Ingrid's work in different ways. In my own work in intercultural communication and TESOL and social linguistics, I was drawn to Ingrid's voice that forces us to question how language and culture have been defined historically to reinforce linguistic hierarchies and social structures that benefit the privileged few. We have watched such inequalities play out with destructive results in the US and in Philadelphia, where Black Lives Matter protest and voting procedures are being challenged, and where the current pandemic disproportionately affects minorities, the job of language educators goes beyond teaching about grammar. Ingrid's work reminds us how language and culture and attitudes towards language and culture create and maintain inequalities that profoundly shape our lives.
Now, so, it was 2009, December 2009, when I went to American University of Sharjah and Zayed University. They were hosting a conference on fostering multiliteracies through education. And I was a naive doctoral student presenting my work. And after the conference was over, I saw an email. And that email, somebody was seeking my permission to publish my work on Language on the Move. And when I saw that, it was Professor Ingrid Piller. And my doctoral supervisor had talked to me about Dr. Piller's work. So first, I did not believe that it was from Professor Piller asking me to publish my work. So I asked my colleague, I said, hey, can you see this is from Professor Ingrid Piller? He said, yes. So this is how we became friends. And since then, I saw Dr. Piller as a mentor throughout my PhD and after my PhD. And visiting Language on the Move regularly gave me a very different view of linguistics, which is not very traditional, I would say. My doctoral work on signage and linguistic ethnography heavily draw on her. And as I said that throughout my PhD and after my PhD, she has been the shaping person on my scholarship, on my personality. And I'm so thrilled and honored that I am here in her presence today and interviewing her. I'm super, super excited and would like to thank Carla to include me in this one. Thank you.
Thank you so much, both, for having me. And I just have to say, I remember that conference in Sharjah very fondly. It was a really international conference in an Arabic-speaking context and at the same time in an English-speaking context. So very diverse. And we were actually handing out awards for the best paper of the day. And Khan had actually disappeared by the time we kind of, you know, got around to announcing that this was the best paper of the day.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you.
Well, we have a lot of questions for you, but obviously we won't be able to get to everything. I use both of your books in my classes, and I just, as soon as I found them, I just thought, yes, this is it. This is what I want my students to be reading, because I feel like I was just cobbling together all these different chapters and articles from applied linguistics and other sources that take a critical look at language and teaching and culture. But here I feel like, yes, you've brought all of this together. So I'm really, really grateful for that. And I also think that, at least when I'm reading what you do, obviously your scholarly work is amazing, but I also feel that there's passion there, there's a mission there. And I wonder, like, what defining moments, you know, in your life, like, led you to that? I mean, you're multilingual, you know, I've read about your experiences, but was there anything in particular that really, like, motivated you to just pursue, like, social justice and,
It's a difficult question to answer, and I kind of always resist this, like, I don't know, road to Damascus narrative. I think we all make our lives and careers in path and journeys. And I was educated in a rural area of southern Bavaria, in an area where grammar schools didn't exist, so high schools didn't exist until about my generation. So I'm the first in my from my village, actually, to go to high school, to graduate from high school. So, of course, my upbringing has shaped me. Then I received my higher education in Germany, but I studied to become a teacher, mm-hmm. specifically a language teacher. So the languages that I focused on were English, German, and Spanish. And from there, I went on various exchanges to the UK. And my first postdoctoral position was actually in the US at Ithaca College as a visiting professor in the English department there. And then my career has taken me to various other places, including the United Arab Emirates, Switzerland, and now in Australia.
Mm-hmm. I have students who are getting a minor in TESOL with the hopes of going abroad and having the chance to teach. And I think I mentioned to you that for many, it's, you know, this is a kind of once in a lifetime opportunity to be able to do this. But they are also, and I'm glad they're questioning this, they're questioning the moral aspects of it. And some of them feel conflicted about wanting to go abroad and teach English and get experience. And I mean, that's what I did, you know, many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. And it changed my life. It changed my world. But at the same time, I think back, I thought, oh my gosh, I was part of this whole system of Englishization of, you know, of Korea where I was working. But my students now today are asking me, how do they do this? How do they reconcile this? And well, I told them I would ask you.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a difficult question, really. I mean, I've been thinking about this since you kind of flagged this question to me. I think it's the same answer, actually, that we give to anyone who works in an unjust system. I mean, we live in an imperfect world, and imperfect is probably a euphemism. We live in very difficult structures, but that doesn't mean we should not act at all. I mean, it's the same question that we could ask any white person, you know, should we go and teach or should we just shut up? And of course we should, but at the same time, I think, you know, you can't give up being a teacher because you have a particular identity. The same goes for, you know, should men teach women? I mean, that's all positions of privilege carry these moral questions, I think. And coming back to the specific question of should Americans or native speakers of English, should they become teachers of English? Look, I still don't see why not. I mean, as long, and I think that's the caveat, as long as they also pay attention to the kinds of structures we've been talking about. And as long as they teach under the assumption that, you know, they're teaching the next generation of teachers. Because I think one fundamental problem that can make the privileged teaching the disadvantaged so difficult is But very often it's on the assumption like the privileged identity is forever the teacher identity, and non-native speakers or people of color or women, they'll never be as good as. And that kind of assumption is pernicious. So I think we need to teach to actually, to teach so that our students will replace ourselves, that they will be the next generation. And that to me is, it's more an ethical than a linguistic question, but it's the question that any teacher needs to ask themselves all the time, really. How is my teaching meaningful to my students, and how does it contribute to questions of social justice? How does it reinforce existing structures, and how can I help to be part of the solution as opposed to be part of the problem?
Yeah, exactly.
So Ingrid, I have a question about the loss of multiliteracy in my family. So we moved to United States in 2013, my wife, I, and four kids. And when we moved, three of our four kids were bilingual and biliterate with English and Urdu. And the youngest one was 3 years old, so he wasn't bilingual, he was only monolingual. Ingrid, in these 7 years, I have seen in my family, my monolingual ones, they have, although they can speak Urdu and they do speak Urdu, they've totally forgotten Urdu script. They cannot read, nor they can write. So when my wife and I, we make conscious effort, my little boy, he says, when you love your Urdu language so much, why on earth you brought us to United States? And he asked these questions to us, because for him, United States mean it's English only. Mm-hmm. So, and this question is not of that child. I come across this question from so many people around, from political debates and all these. So my question is, in such a case as I am in, what agency do I have as a father, as a family member, to help my kids, you know, retain their language heritage?
Yeah, that's a difficult question, and I think one that many migrant parents struggle with. And I think there are two aspects that I'd like to speak to. One is the literacy question. And that's sort of a very typical pattern, of course, in migrant families, that you actually have the second generation. They are bilingual, they can speak the language, but they don't have good or at all literacy skills and don't know how to read and write the other language. And that, of course, I mean, it's great that they can speak in the family Urdu or whatever, but at the same time, it really cuts them off from the cultural heritage of the language and the literature, and also the kind of academic and cognitive development that actually comes through literacy in any language. So, of course, literacy is extremely important, but at the same time, the hardest to maintain. And, of course, it's not surprising that it's hard to maintain, because you know, in any context, it's the school's job. The parent's job is oracy and oral skills, and that's what happens in the family. And we have outsourced literacy teaching to schools, and that's true pretty much universally. So in order to be able to maintain literacy in a language that is not the school language, I think you have to invest like a phenomenal amount of time and resources, and that's just, you know, usually not a feasible proposition for most people. So it really only works if you actually have community schools, or if you have the support of the school. And that's why I actually think to have language learning and bilingualism in the school system is so important. And so one thing that we all need to be lobbying for in these monolingual countries, or these countries with a monolingual ideologies, as the United States, but also Australia, is actually languages in the school system. And I think that actually is something that speaks also to the non-migrant population, because often bilingualism is seen like this is a migrant problem, right? And it's a community problem, and you know, you do whatever you want, just don't speak it in public and leave us alone. And but in order for actually languages to be valued, of course, everyone needs to see something in them. And coming from a context where, you know, even in continental Europe, you can't actually become an educated person if you don't learn another language. I mean, at the very minimum, you have to learn English. Otherwise, I mean, that's part of education. And the European ideal, for instance, is that every citizen learns two foreign languages, so the national language, English, and the language of a neighboring country. In many parts of the world, bilingual education has always been a reality and is not unusual at all. And so the Anglo-Saxon world at the moment is really a bit of an exception there. And I think one thing that we just need to push for also is the importance of learning another language. To me, it's like, you know, math or learning language arts. It really opens your mind in ways that you just can't understand if you haven't had that experience of language learning. And so it's not only, to me, it's not only a social justice issue that affects like minorities and migrant people. It's really for everyone. We should lobby for everyone that language learning does something to you that gives you an insight into another culture and into another world. And, you know, you can read more things. You can just, it broadens you. And in the same way that I think, you know, no one debates that, you know, oh, should we really learn math, or should our children learn math? And that's such, you know, takes so much time. We just consider it natural. And languages are the same, really. They should be a normal, expected part of becoming an educated person.
Interestingly, I ask my students in an introduction to social linguistics class, now at my campus, we are 57% minority. We don't know the exact number of multilingual students, because we can't collect all of that information, but quite a few. Typically in a class, I have three monolingual students, monolingual English students, and the rest are multilingual. So I asked them, are we a monolingual or multilingual nation? And these are, you know, young people, and they say, we're multilingual. And it's really, I was taken aback the first time, but then I have them go out and, you know, look, make observations, and then kind of come back to me and say, how are we monolingual or how are we multilingual? And of course, you know, they realize then that we are multilingual in the private sphere. It's okay on the social, you know, to talk to your family, to use multiple languages with your friends, but then you get into the public sphere and it's English. So I get to kind of look at that. But I was surprised the first time when they all came back and said, we're multilingual. And I was like, we are, and it's statistically, but not with, you know, it's still a monolingual mindset.
Yeah, it's really institutions that reinforce this idea of, I mean, we have to operate institutionally in a monolingual world. And that's what makes it so difficult, and really also creates this disconnect between the lived experience of many people. But I also agree. I mean, it's sort of beautiful to see, actually, that there is a younger generation who is much more attuned to different languages, and also keen to maintain languages. I mean, one thing that I see a lot is actually that there is this resistance in young children in particular. So primary school is like the time when they when they say things like, so why did you bring us to this country, or we are in the US now, so let's speak English. And so it's really also this developmental stage where they want to fit in and where they really buy into monolingualism. And as parents, I think you have to work a bit to kind of get them through these couple of years, because by the time they're teenagers, having another language is actually a source of distinction, and that's when they enjoy their languages again. So I think if you can support your child through that kind of assimilist phase that children go through, then actually they will thank you for it once they're
absolutely correct, Ingrid. My boys who are in universities, one is in Swarthmore, the other is in Denison, both of them are now so much in love with Urdu. And they are at that stage. And you are 100% correct. Mm-hmm. But the little one, you know, he's still reacting. Yeah. Hey, why to US when you would love Urdu so much? Why didn't you stay back? Yeah, you're so right. Yeah, you're so right.
I've experienced that with my daughter. I was determined to, I didn't think she was going to, you know, be speaking French, but I spoke French to her from the day she was born, just trying to, you know, see what would happen. And she just resisted it. She got to the point, we would read a lot of children's books and she could read them. But then at a certain point, she just, you know, didn't want to have anything to do with it. Like you said, elementary school. And now she's studying French. So.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah, so it did come back. So, all right, I'll move on to another topic, and that is, you know, language and the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And your recent special issue in Multilingua, you had said that you received, I think, hundreds of proposals, and you decided to focus on China. And then you also just recently had a symposium this past weekend. And I just wondered, since the publication, things are changing so quickly with this pandemic. What have you seen change in terms of, you know, language issues and public health? And if you could do another special issue, part two, where do you think you would go with it?
Right. Look, when we sent out the call for papers in March, and we received, as you said, over 200 abstracts from really around the globe. So clearly a lot of interest. But at the same time, we decided on China then, just to make our selection task easier, because we felt like China was 2-3 months ahead in the pandemic. They were at that point winning the fight against the pandemic, and it sort of seemed to us like there maybe was a course to it, and, you know, other nations would go through a phase of outbreaks but then get it under control in the same way that China had done. And of course, that has now been proven completely wrong. So at the same time, you know, I think it's a really important study to just see what a very different country has done, that has a very different setup from the Western setup, and one that we often don't think of as a highly linguistically diverse nation, because China, in fact, is incredibly linguistically diverse. So there is the standard language and the various varieties of Chinese that are often called dialects, but in reality are not necessarily mutually intelligible. So they really constitute different languages when it comes to everyday interaction and communication. And then there are over 55 counted minorities, so different languages in the country. We've heard a lot about Mongolian recently, which is one of the larger minority languages, but also, Southwest China is very linguistically diverse, so many different languages. And then China is increasingly becoming a migrant destination for international students in particular, particularly from places like Southeast Asia and Africa, the developing world in particular. So an aspect of migration that I think in the West is not being recognized at all. So we have a really linguistically diverse situation and so interesting challenges when it comes to how do you communicate timely, high quality information as is necessary in a pandemic or in any crisis, and how do you do that? Well, that was a special issue. Now, how would I do it differently, or what would the sequel look like? sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I said part two, right.
Like, part two, yes. So the sequel, two aspects that I would want to do, and I mean, I think there are a zillion others, but one thing is actually to look at situations in the Global South where, again, we have highly linguistically diverse situations with Indigenous minorities in particularly disadvantaged and exceedingly high risk of the pandemic. And some of my students in master's course I'm teaching devoted to literacies actually did many research projects this semester. And I just want to share some of their research findings. So for instance, one of my students, Kinsa Abbasi, she actually did, Han, that will be particularly of interest to you, a study of how information about COVID-19 was communicated in Khyber Pashtun province in Pakistan. And
wow,
that is a highly linguistically diverse province. I think there are 18 different languages spoken there. Most of the population actually is not literate in those languages. So if they've had an education, they will be literate in Urdu and maybe English. All the public information, all the campaigns that she looked at was published predominantly in English and a bit in Urdu, but nothing in any of the other languages.
Wow.
And even more interestingly, some of the information was really completely nonsensical. So she showed us posters where there was a sheep, and the sheep was crossed out, like, and then said something like, don't go near animals. Wow. Now, actually, sheep herding is like one of the key livelihoods. So it's absurd information.
True.
And of course, communicated through the wrong channels, because posters are not actually something that works particularly well. And another student, Alexandra Hermosa from Peru, also had similar findings. She also looked at posters that were actually translated into the indigenous languages of the Andes, various languages, and she looked at Quechua posters in particular. And one thing that she found was, so again, it's not the ideal communication channel to actually provide posters. And also the communication strategy relied heavily on the internet in a context where there actually isn't widespread mobile coverage. And again, she found information like, you know, wash your hands all the time, and don't forget to turn off the tap after you've washed your hands. That's one of the things that it said in Quechua, except few of these villages, they don't have running water. So again, the information just is, so there's so much wrong. And it's, again, I think a Western mass communication model that is being applied there. You work through posters, you work through national languages, you have one set of communication, one set of information, whether that's locally relevant or not. And another of my students, Yuda Hidayat from Indonesia, he actually suggested, like, one of the key information channels that people in Lombok province trust is through the mosques, and there is an established communication channel, like how you share information across villages through loudspeakers on the mosques and through mosque community. And that one wasn't used. So like indigenous communication channels on the grounds are neglected in favor of, you know, those kinds of information channels that don't actually get the information to the people.
Yeah,
that's another research.
Very fascinating, very fascinating findings. It's like getting a model from somewhere else mm-hmm. and applying somewhere else without regard to anything.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Wow.
Well, yeah, modalities are so important, and they shape the communication, but also you were talking about it. I was just going to say, what is the best way to reach different populations? Certainly the internet it's not even going to reach me. I'm not even on social media. It's just fascinating that people try to apply the exact same model, what works here to
right.
other places. And I see a lot of signage here. Obviously there's, you know, every newspaper has like free COVID information, every newspaper online. So you don't have to be subscribed to the newspaper, but you still have to have the setup to go to that newspaper, you know, to have the online resources. And I know New York Times translates into Spanish, but that's it. I didn't see other languages.
And then this also brings us to the question of trust. And I think one thing that we've seen in the pandemic, and particularly in countries like the US, I think, but really many other parts of the world, is of course a complete breakdown of trust. And that's why actually these fake news and disinformation proliferate, because there is a lot of communication going on, but you don't actually know where it comes from. It doesn't seem like, it's trustworthy sources. And part of the problem, to my mind, is actually the communication channels don't match, the languages don't match, the sources are anonymous. You don't actually make use of the kind of communication channels that people trust and that people know. And ultimately, a crisis response, of course, needs to be led by the state, but it also needs to be local. It needs to be, and the state kind of needs to enable local action. And those kinds of countries that really have been able to respond at all kinds of levels, so at the national level, at institutional levels, but really also at community level, and mobilize people who actually door knock, people who translate. Loudspeakers have been very successfully used in parts of China, rural parts of Vietnam, mm-hmm. for instance. So the kind of communication channels that are known to work. The other thing that was pointed out by that student that I mentioned who worked in Khyber Pashtun province
mm-hmm.
Was also that just communication to be successful actually needs to be filtered like through tribal leaders, and it needs to actually go through families in order to reach both men and women.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
if that doesn't happen, it's kind of, you could just as well save the paper you are printing on, you're printing your flyers on.
Right. And to say here, you can't even identify those pathways of trust. You know, I mean, it's different for everyone. And I also know, like, students, there's such a abundance of information, and sometimes people just end up shutting it all off because they don't even know where to turn to anymore. And like you said, they don't really trust any sources. And that's definitely been a big problem. I hope it gets a little bit better. We'll see. We have some hope.
We live in hope. That's the moral imperative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ingrid, can I ask a question on multilingual research? Changing a topic a little bit. When I see research on multilingualism, rarely do I come across references of scholarship outside English. So the proponents of multilingualism are often restricted to monolingual literature itself. When I was reading your book, surprisingly, positively, I came across the reference of Isfahan in the 17th century. And I was like taken aback. I said, wow, this is new for me. that started this thinking in me that, you know, our multilingual research scholarship is mostly monolingual, and it's a paradox. So I was thinking that I would seek your comment. And before you do that, I also wanted to show you the diploma, the degree that my university, Karachi University, gave me. It's a very bilingual, you see, half Urdu, mm-hmm. and half English. So it's like the space is divided between Urdu and English, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas my degree in Lancaster was absolutely monolingual. It's almost impossible to imagine that in America, a university giving a degree with English and Spanish side by side. Mm-hmm. So the point I'm making is this one, is that sometimes when we go out of the box to nations, we find lots of things, you know, which are so interesting and illuminating, like in the case of Isfahan that you talked about, or like in the case of Karachi University giving degrees in, you know, Urdu and English. Yeah. Any comment?
Yes, look, I couldn't agree more. You know, 100% correct. Our scholarship is exceedingly monolingual, exceedingly English-centric. It's not just monolingual, it's English, actually. And that is a problem, precisely because of the examples we discussed earlier. Because, of course, if we do research in a multilingual context and only see one linguistic side of things, we're bound to miss, you know, so many other sides. So that's obvious. It's a fundamental problem, I think, of research across the board, actually. I wrote a paper in 2016 in the Journal of Multicultural Discourses about monolingual ways of seeing multilingualism. And that was a response to research by Anthony Lidicote, who had looked at a sample of research in multilingualism and just looked at in what kind of context does that multilingualism occur? I mean, what are the research contexts? And he found that about a third actually had no context at all. It was just like, you know, yeah, context-free theorizing about multilingualism. So that was a really large part. And I think that is a consequence of the English centrism of the field, because if you actually only see English, then, you know, multilingualism is something airy-fairy that's out there, but is not really bound to a particular context. And then the large, another 40%, I would say, I forget the exact numbers, I mean, you can look them up. A very large chunk was then about bilingualism in the English-speaking world, so UK, US, Australia, with migrant or indigenous populations, mostly migrant populations, and then a smaller chunk of research in other contexts, multilingualism in other contexts, but really most of it through the lens of English. And I guess a big problem, of course, here are publishing structures and how different research is valued and evaluated and assessed. And there is, in all fields across the board, of course, this assumption built into all kinds of metrics that, like, English publications are better automatically. And so that puts many academics across the world really under pressure to publish through the medium of English. But in order to be able to publish through the medium of English, and particularly to publish in international journals, you A, need to work with frameworks that appeal in the metropolis, in the center, right, because you don't get published if you have some, you know, I mean, framework, conceptual framework is really, really important, and being part of the discussion, of the conversation, you only can be part of the international global conversation if you actually speak to the concerns that are there in the journal. So it's not only about language choice. The key problem really is that this English centrism changes the content of our research because we consistently ignore local considerations. As I've just said, with regard to the way COVID is communicated in rural areas in the global south, I mean, this kind of the ignorance is in part related to English Western centric ways of doing things. So it's really to the great detriment of everyone that these kinds of relationships pertain. The question is always, how can we change that? And we are little people, and one thing that I think as university teachers, one thing that we should be lobbying for in terms of policy, for instance, is that actually anyone who becomes a language teacher should actually also have learned a language. So it seems to me like really strange that we continue to like graduate linguistics degrees or TESOL degrees, and there was no study requirement to have studied another language. That to me is something that we can do, for instance. One thing that I try to do through Language on the Move, for instance, because we also have a great opportunity with digital communication. So it's no longer either or. I mean, in the traditional paper journal, of course, it was more like, you know, you have one shot at it and you have a particular page limit, but that no longer pertains in the digital world either. So we can actually create more kind of academic and community spaces, and that's the responsibility ultimately. I mean, everyone sort of needs to come to the table and try and also disseminate their research. So those of us who work in the West and who work through the medium of English, I think the bare minimum that we should be doing for our research is actually to also create translations and create other channels. So that's, for instance, what we've been doing with the special issue that we've just published on linguistic diversity in a time of crisis. The symposium that you mentioned that we just had this weekend, we actually ran two parallel sessions. And they weren't in parallel, but we ran two sessions. One was an English language channel and a session, and the other was a Chinese session. And brought together key researchers in the Chinese space and really targeted at a Chinese audience, and try to disseminate the research beyond those who speak English. Because ultimately, if we look at it from a global perspective, it's of course only a very small number of privileged few who actually speak English to or have proficiency in English to the kind of level that allows them to, absorb academic information. So these are some of the things that we need to push against.
Yeah, we need changes in publishing. I've been on editorial boards and I'm an editor now, and I know that the publishers, they only want to publish in English. And, you know, it's a journal about interculturalism and they're resistant. So we find ourselves having to insist on English in the field of intercultural communication and intercultural education. And that's cutting out so many people. But I don't know how to fix it right away. But
academic papers, can I just say that, is also that it's extremely rigid. So because it's not always, an either or question, like English or Chinese or something. Of course, in everyday communication, as we all know, bilingual people communicate through translanguaging and code switching and in all kinds of ways. But academic journal articles, of course, are at the most rigid and extreme end of the monolingual spectrum. And so it's not only that we publish in English, but we publish in standard English that shouldn't have any traces of
anything else.
So that creates an additional barrier.
In most regulated spaces. Yeah.
Khan, as you've said, interesting tension really there, but it's often, you know, many of us kind of rail against the monolingual mindset, but at the same time, when it comes to our own practices, it's of course highly regulated.
And
I feel, and in higher education, you know, I'm just hopefully I'm coming up with the proposal, something that we can do, not just to like just validate our students' multilingualism, but use it, let them use it. So, you know, we can recognize it, we can value it, but what are we asking them to do in languages other than English? Why can't they write a paper, you know, like for some kind of capstone project, before they graduate, why can't they take that paper, that information, and disseminate it in another language through a blog or, you know, through a community organization? So I'm hoping to kind of put something together like that. But it's going to be a lot of work, a lot of convincing people that it's a worthwhile endeavor. I think it is, but I know it's not going to be easy. But we have to start with something structurally, I think, just giving... just talking about it and, you know, talking about being inclusive. And I just feel like we're talking and talking and talking and talking and not really doing. I don't know how, like at your university or other schools, like how do you really let students use multiple languages?
Not really in our university. I mean, so it's very much an Anglo university in an English speaking country, or a country that sees itself as English speaking. But I guess one thing that I would like to add to your thoughts kind of is that we see overall around the world, we see an increasing valorization of diversity, and that's great. I mean, I think that really needs to happen. But at the same time, I think we also need to continue to critically examine how discourses of diversity can actually coexist with very exclusionary practices. And one issue that I see for people from minority backgrounds as they enter the academy in particular, and how they and as they grapple with these questions of standard English, monolingualism, multilingualism, translanguaging, using all their languages, is of course that this is not entirely up to them. I mean, they enter ways of seeing, and minoritized populations are also seen as linguistically deficient. So for anyone from a non-native, people of color, migrants, disadvantaged backgrounds or underprivileged backgrounds, to actually succeed, they always have to battle this double bind. On the one hand, they may want to use all their linguistic repertoire. On the other hand, if they do, they are still prone to be seen as linguistically deficient. And like, what's one person's creativity is another person's error, right? And so these kinds of tensions are something that I think one thing that we can do is actually help our students come to terms with these tensions and learn how to live with them, or learn to recognize them at least. I mean, that's maybe the most emancipatory thing we can do as teachers, to talk to them about and you know, let them talk about their experiences, but kind of acknowledge that it's not only something that we can do. I mean, we are actors, but at the same time, everyone's reach is limited. And so it's also about building new communities
and
I mean, Khan, you wanted to say something. I've been going on a bit.
No, I really want to discuss with you the discourse of world Englishes. If you have 5 minutes.
5 minutes?
Yeah.
Englishes?
Ingrid, when I was introduced this whole field of world Englishes, I really admired it a lot because it gave me how the field of English was attached to a few countries and how this was liberating. The whole scholarship was liberating. And coming from Pakistan and South Asia, I became very confident. I was talking to Professor Carla before the interview. I found myself as a legitimate teacher of English because of this whole scholarship of world Englishes. So I was a great admirer initially when this was introduced to me. But when I was introduced the field of multilingualism, my professor taught me, then I started looking at the relationship between these two fields. And I was finding them so puzzling, because when I used to read Kachru and other pioneers, I used to see the whole world through the lens of Englishes only, as if there was nothing in the world but English. And then from the other seminar, I had this bombardment of multilingualism, that the world is entirely multilingual. In India, you drive 40 miles, you come across a new language. The relationship between these two, I've never been able to, you know, understand this. Could you say something, how these two scholarships relate to one another?
I think you've got a bit too high expectations of me. So I certainly wouldn't presume to be able to resolve those. Just one thought or two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The world English's paradigm, of course, comes out of the original sin of the modern world. It's a colonial paradigm. Ultimately, it comes out of colonialism and slavery. And even if our academic discourse is that we value all varieties of English and so on and so forth, it only actually makes sense within a colonial world. And so that's that about world Englishes. Now, of course, it has made immense contributions. And we continue to live in this colonial or post-colonial, in the world that was shaped by colonialism. So, of course, the way English works in that world is tied to our global order. So that's a fact. And that English predominates is a fact. And we try and find our way around it as we do as humans, and as we try to navigate the world in which we live and make it a better place to the degree that we can. Now, how does this all relate to multilingualism?
Yes.
One interesting relationship to me is actually, I'm very interested in the history of the Mughal Empire and the Persian language. And so the Mughal Empire, for those who don't know, was kind of this trans-Asian empire, Muslim empire that existed in what is today pretty much the subcontinent and other parts of Central and Asia, existed prior to British colonization. And now their imperial order was a highly multilingual imperial order. So Persian was the language of writing, of the courts, and every educated person would learn how to write in Persian, and there was a whole class of scribes who got their livelihoods out of being able to read and write documents in Persian. But at the same time, Urdu and Hindi and a wide variety of also literate and non-literate languages played important roles in art, in poetry, in the imperial structure. And then there was the holy language of Islam, Arabic, that all was in the mix, kind of. And in the transition from the Mughal Empire to the British Empire, Persian was initially used by the British in their administration of colonial India, because the people they needed to run the country, of course, were all those scribes and bureaucrats and administrators who spoke Persian. But gradually, Persian was being replaced by English, and not only was Persian being replaced, but the whole multilingual ecology was being changed over to a more monolingually oriented or English-centric ecology. And so I guess the way to maybe resolve the tension between the scholarship around multilingualism and the scholarship in world Englishes is actually to think about how these two linguistic orders are part of social orders.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes, I know. I'm just thinking and thinking now. Ingrid, I don't know how much time you have, actually. We didn't talk about that. I don't want to overstep.
Yeah, look, I'm really enjoying this conversation at the same time. Maybe we'll just also, I mean, you want to show this at your conference, right?
So yeah,
there will be a limit to how much time there is.
I
do have one more question I want to sneak in. I wrote this to you last night, and I pretty much just ended with the question, will we ever get over Hofstede? It's just, everybody goes back to that. And I'm just thinking, I've had some lines like ways to respond, but I just sometimes feel like I'm just talking to a brick wall or something, because it's, of course I know why it's popular. It's easy knowledge. It's like, oh yes, we can just classify people's behaviors according to these worldviews, and you know, attach them to nations. And then it's just, and then I read the literature in our field and I'm like, oh yeah, we're over that. But then I go to a workshop or a webinar and it comes back to me, and I don't know if I wondered if you were experiencing some of that still, or I'm waiting for that like pithy kind of comeback I can have. But it just hangs on, doesn't it? I think this idea that we can just first of all define cultures in terms of national boundaries, and then just define those cultures, those national cultures, by things like individualism, collectivism, masculinity, femininity, and
it does hang on. But you know what, I mean, so many things, so many discourses are hanging on, and I'm kind of there's this I think Saint Francis who said, you know, you, God grant me the wisdom to change the things I can change and accept the things I can't change, and always know the difference between the two. And I think some of those forever essentialist discourses,
yeah,
I mean, they're deplorable, but at the same time, it's not something I at the moment really want to waste my time on, because life is short.
Yes, I'll just make sure people read your books.
Yes.
How's that?
Well, this was a lovely conversation. I really enjoyed talking to you guys.
It was wonderful. Oh my gosh, it was great.
I hope to meet you.
As I said at the beginning, I mean, there are always ways to look at the bright side too. And this is certainly one of the positive things that has come out of this pandemic. We wouldn't have had this conversation if it hadn't been for the pandemic. And so I think, you know, one opportunity that I see is actually for greater engagement across national borders and across these kinds of barriers, as we've all just, you know, kind of our lives have been sucked into Zoom, but we can really also use those to have these conversations amongst different people from different backgrounds and across borders. And so there is also this opportunity that we can reach out more, and that's, I think that's a very important thing.